Because of this, I want you to, one of the reasons I want you to, I did this is I want you to be able to listen. Sometimes you, if you get taking notes in the class, you're so busy getting one thing down, you miss the professor says next, and you get behind. So I want you to, you know, listen, you can follow the discussion, you can listen to the discussion without worrying too much about the notes. But secondly, that when it comes time for testing, I test harder in a class for which I have prepared a complete syllabus than I do when I didn't. So you understand that. You'll be responsible for everything in the syllabus. I don't grade, you know, every lot of minutiae. You'll find out how I grade, but I've already said I don't make you responsible for the material that's in the reading only. You know, in other words, I'm not going to grade you according to letter A. But keep that in mind, so don't get lazy. That's the one drawback of a complete syllabus. Sometimes you get lazy. And you think, well, there it is. And just because it's in your hand, you think it's in your head. And make sure it gets in your head, okay? We're coming out. We continue our discussion on the expansion of Gentile Christianity. And again, we're using the term Gentile versus vis-a-vis Jewish Christianity in a cultural, not a doctrinal sense. And and we're talking about the fact that it's amazing that the church spread, sort of as rapid as it did in the world in which it spread. We've already made the comment that movement in history which was spread by persuasion spread as rapidly, and we're considering the fact now that it was spread in the face of bitter opposition. Now, we talked about some of the factors that were sort of prepared the way for the gospel. So there were cultural factors, historic factors, usually most attached to the Roman Empire and its character, which were conducive to the growth of the church, but it faced opposition from the society. And I was discussing at the close of the last hour its struggle with state religion, and somebody asked me a question after class, I forget who it was, which indicated that I may have left the wrong impression. When I said, and we'll come back to this I think today, but let me straighten it out right here. When I said that the Christians got in trouble because they insisted on speaking out for their faith, you know, I was not criticizing that. I think that they understood the Christian faith very well. We're going to see that today. I didn't want to leave the impression in our discussion that the Christians were unnecessarily zealous in the public proclamation of their faith. I don't think you can get, it's hard to get unnecessarily zealous. But the church was proscribed in many areas of the empire. Now, we're going to see as we get into this that there was not universal persecution of the church. The church was proscribed at various times in various parts of the empire, and for the reason that all totalitarian states must control religious thought, at least the profession of religious thought. So the church was not licensed. It was illegal after about the end of the first century. There were popular feelings against the church. It wasn't just the government that was against the church. There was a great deal of popular feeling against the church. And remember, I've already talked about the fact that remember superstition contributed to the persecution of the church. They blamed the Christians when there was earthquakes and floods and famines. Well, there was a great deal of a popular misunderstanding about the church, and I list this. First of all, the church was there were three charges laid against the church. This would be an excellent test question, wouldn't it? Three charges were laid against the church. First of all, the charge that the church was practicing abominations. The love feasts were misunderstood, and we're going to come back to this later. But you realize, of course, that the early church met together every first day of the week, and they ate every Sunday. Their primary meeting was their, in other words, they met in the evenings, met at nights, and they met at night, and they always ate when they came together. The agape, love feast. You know, James, for instance, talks about hidden rocks in your love feast. The heathen were misunderstood this. You see, they were used to love feasts, but when they kind of love feasts, they were used to in some of the mystery religions and some of the pagan temples and just in society. When you said love feast, though, it wasn't agape love; it was eros. There were orgies. get together and eat for an evening of overeating and sexual perversion. And in the church, and so the church got together and they met sort of off by themselves. They said, well, these are love feasts. They said, aha, yeah, we know all about love feasts. You see, and these are misunderstood. The Lord's Supper was seen to be blood drinking, especially that of children. They would misunderstand this. You can see why they might. Because ignorant people, superstitious people, and these Christians get together and they have a feast. They have a special part of their love feast every week. And what do? Well, they have they eat something, and when they talk about it, what do they say? Well, this is the blood, the body and blood of the Lord. This is flesh and blood. And so it was often misunderstood as being blood drinking and that kind of thing. Sometimes the blood of children, it was mentioned. The rumors got started, yes.
Was there indication of child sacrifice?
No. Just rumors got started, you know. And
I'm not speaking of being Christian.
Oh, no, there was no child sacrifice in the Roman Empire. There was child sacrifice back in the ancient Canaanite Empire. But there was no child sacrifice in the Roman Empire.
What would make them think? Put here, especially that of children.
It's just a rumor. There's no reason to make them think that. It's just the kind of rumors got started. Interesting, parallel to this is, this was a superstitious age, and this superstition carried on to the Dark Ages. The question is, why would they suggest that they were drinking the blood of children? Just something that gets going, it's hard to stamp out. There's all kinds of stories. Stories get spread, even among the Christians today. Stories get spread, and they just get told and told and believed. You know, like Joshua's missing day has been found in the computer bank. We heard that story, you know, which is not true. It's like worms in McDonald's hamburgers. And, you know, you go on, and this is not true. All kinds of stories. They're just believed. And by the way, this was sort of picked up and turned around in the Middle Ages. The Christians accused the Jews of doing this. The Jews were secretly getting together. They would kidnap Christian children and drain their blood and drink their blood. And they were going to kill Jews. It's one of the things they would accuse them of. Some of these stories that got pointed in another direction, but never quite got stopped. And they met at night, and that was suspect. They nocturnal meetings. But why did they meet at night? Well, most of them, the only time they could meet. They didn't get Sunday off. we're going to see later that one thing, you know, I was laughing, the Seventh-day Adventists tried to talk about the church borrowed Sunday keeping from the Romans as a pagan holiday. Well, the problem is the Romans didn't have any Sunday. They didn't have any first day holiday for the Christians to borrow. That'll be one of the most historically absurd arguments in the world. In fact, they didn't even have a 7-day week. They divided the month into roughly 2 15-day, the Ides and the Calends. We got our word Calends, calendar, from the 1 15-day, roughly 15-day section, and the Ides was the 15th of March. Remember, Julius Caesar, beware of the Ides of March. They didn't have a 7-day week, didn't have a first day Sunday observance, a first day holiday. So anyway, you've heard that argument that the church borrowed Sunday from the Romans? The Romans didn't have one to borrow. And so they had to work. Many of the Christians were slaves, and so they just met at night. Let me give an example I hope I create some interest. And you bought this copy of the New Eusebius. It's a tremendously valuable topical collection of writings. I wish I'd had it when I was going to undergraduate school. It was out of print for a long time. Now it's back in print. But an example. Clement of Alexandria, he's talking about this problem. What he's talking about is the problem of the church being misunderstood. And if we are called to the kingdom of God, let us walk worthy of the kingdom, loving God and our neighbor. But love is not tested by a kiss, but by a kindly feeling. But there are those that do nothing but make the churches resound with the kiss, not having love itself within. For this very thing, the shameless use of the kiss, which ought to be mystic, has occasioned foul suspicions and evil reports. I put that in your copy of the syllabus, didn't I? Now, the kiss of peace, by the way, was practiced. It was like our shaking hands. The men kissed the men, the women kissed the women. But there are many people in the church who nobody ever loved them before. And, you know, it's this thing of You know, it's interesting that the church, when it began, had the same problem with relational theology that the church is having today. Well, they didn't call it relational theology. You know, they started out in the prayer room, ended up in the bedroom too often. And some were taking advantage of this. They were turning into a sensuous thing. And I think that's a real warning. I think we're very careful with this kind of thing, don't we? He says what he's saying, of course, is we got some in the church who are misusing the holy kiss, the kiss of peace, and they get started and can't get stopped, and we're being criticized for it. He said, well, watch this, because we're being criticized enough the way it is, we needn't give them any ammunition. Well, and so the charge was sort of generally practicing abominations, and I've sort of broken it down in three different examples. The second charge was hating the human race. Now this sprang, as I indicate, from the separation from Roman life. Now, there were two basic reasons why the Christians early on separated themselves from public life. And by the way, in Roman society, especially in the cities, life was public, more public than it is now. I'll give an example. There were public spectacles almost every day, and they were free, paid for by the state. Bread and circuses they wanted. And mainly, but one of the reasons they did this, especially in Rome, was because the mobs would riot without them. They had... You know, I'm going to the history of this, but they had created a slave class through their wars, and now they had a whole mob of disenfranchised citizens. That is, citizens who were not slaves, but who didn't have any land either. That they had lost their land, or their ancestors had lost their land, and economic factors, which are very complicated. But so you had thousands and thousands of Romans who were with a mob. Got that? Free citizens, but who had no land, had no way to make a living, and some of them, many of them wouldn't work. Yeah. Often, they had a business class of merchants and artisans, craftsmen, but most of those were slaves. And it's very common to see slaves that were financially well off had themselves owned slaves, owned businesses, while freemen, Roman citizens, were on welfare. And to keep these people happy, they would sort of like, remember Orwell's 1984, the mobs were kept occupied with pornography. Well, he got this from ancient Rome, Orwell did. That's how they kept the mobs sort of pacified, kept them distracted, occupied with the pornography of and violence of the spectacles. Well, so the Christians would not participate in this. And by the way, let me add another word about public life. You see, the baths were public, most of the toilet facilities were public. There was very little private life in the homes of the common people. That is, they would get up in the morning and leave the house and be gone all day, just about the whole family. It wasn't much staying at home, wasn't much to do at home. Today people see so much television, you know, a lot of times the people can be very happy staying in the house all day. They didn't do this. Public life was a bigger chunk of life, as I'm saying, in the Roman society than it is now. It's hard for us to think about that. But the Romans, the Christians withdrew from this. They withdrew from the games and the spectacles. They withdrew from the military, and we'll talk about this later, but as far as we can tell, the early church fathers were mainly pacifists. And it gets very complicated, but we'll discuss that when the time comes. The public feasts, and they would not hold public office. Now, there were two reasons, and sometimes these reasons combined, like for the public spectacles. One is the simple immorality of these things. They would not go to the public spectacles because of the death because of the violence and the immorality. But secondly, some of these public functions or many aspects of public life, for instance, as holding public office, required oaths to the gods. Well, the reason the Christians wouldn't hold public office was you had to take an oath to the state gods and to the emperor himself. They just wouldn't do this. I don't think we wouldn't, would we? We had to swear to give our full and absolute and primary allegiance to some pagan god, would we take that oath? No, I think not. And the Jehovah's Witnesses won't even do the Pledge of Allegiance, which is not quite the same thing. But anyway, they would not do this. Do y'all see that? So sometimes, first in the public spectacles, they would be dead every time they would have one, they would dedicate them to the gods. Everybody would stand up or whatever they did it. I don't know how they did it. And they would dedicate this to the gods. Well, Christians just weren't going to participate in that. So And so they were called hating the human race. They were unsociable, which is interesting because they were known for their love, but they were just unsociable. And by the way, the Christians, they're accused of that. You ever been accused of that? You know, they just don't, you don't go to the parties, and you won't go out and drink, and you won't go to some of these places. They're just unsociable. So they were saying, well, they hate everybody. They're haters of the human race. Okay, so we've had the abominations, the haters of the human race, and the third charge was atheism. They were accused of being atheists, which again is strange. Well, there was some grounds for this. They did not and could not worship the regional gods, and therefore we've already talked about the fact that the Christians were charged when the gods didn't come through and provide the harvest or didn't protect them from a flood or an earthquake. Okay? Secondly, other religions were more liberal. Rome was full of religions. They had their own traditional Greco-Roman gods in their temples. They had the mystery religions we've talked about. And in fact, one writer said, I think it was Virgil, said that Orion, I think it's the Orion River, has emptied into the Orontes River has emptied into the Nile. Well, the Orontes was the river that runs through Antioch. What he's saying was that all the ancient paganism and mysticism of the East had found its way to Rome. And Rome was full of religions and religion. But it was a case of you worship your gods and I'll worship mine. You go to your church, I'll go to my church. And we'll each recognize the legitimacy of the other's faith. Even the mystery religions, you recall, didn't offer themselves as the way, but what? A way. Well, let's see, the church never did do that. Christians, if the Christians simply said, okay, you worship your God your way, and I worship my God my way, they just weren't very democratic, weren't very liberal. They would say, well, my God's the only one. It's not like a Jew. And the Romans never did like the Jews because of that. And it's either Jesus or nothing. Your religion's wrong and ours is right. Well, the public never does like that. And the third reason, the third contributing factor to the charge of atheism, as I indicate here, was that the pagans could see no idols. Very difficult for them to conceive of the Christians having having a God they couldn't see. And it'd be one of the reasons why the Christians early on adopted the cross as a symbol, very early. Because the pagans, because the Roman, they were people who thought that way. They needed physical symbols. Now again, they should have known this. The Jews had stood very fast on this point for a long time. No idols. But the Jews were generally hated, and often the Jews were accused of the same thing. But you can see why pagans, who found it very difficult to conceive of a god that you couldn't see, had no statue. Or no symbol, visible symbol, saying, well, how can you have, that's no god at all. So the charge of, so they didn't worship the regional gods, didn't worship the state gods. They didn't any other gods that they could see. I mean, temples, we could go and walk into the sanctuary, pull the curtain back and see a statue of it. Then they said, well, you're atheists, no gods. As I'm saying, maybe I'd make this clear, I'm convinced it's one of the reasons why early on, comparatively in the early centuries, the Christians began to have shrines in their homes, and put up little alcoves with a cross on it, and burn a candle, sort of. They were used to this kind of thing. Maybe you don't find it in the very beginning. Okay, we look at the policy of the state toward the church now. In a very specific way. This is very interesting. This extends my discussion on why the state persecuted the church. This is very, very important and quite thrilling, I think. Christianity was regarded as treason, first of all, I point out. Christianity was regarded as treason. I asked the question, the syllabus, was this a groundless charge? Well, traditionally, historians viewed the charge as groundless. The church was not interested in overthrowing the state. However, there was, I think, a little bit of substance to this charge. First of all this talk about the king and the kingdom was suspect and likely to be misunderstood. It was when in Jesus came. Remember Jesus before Pilate? What was the issue? You know, you're accused of claiming to be king, and Caesar is king. And Jesus said, "That's right, I'm a king, but my kingdom is not of this world. Not that kind of king, not that kind of kingdom. Isn't now and is never going to be." Well, and it's interesting. Do you realize that the term, this may be why, and this is just a guess, this may be why the phraseology of the metaphor of the church as the kingdom has very limited use in the epistles. You find it in the book of Acts, in the kerygma, the original apostolic preaching, in the Gospels. That's all you read: king, kingdom, king, kingdom. As one, and not the only, but one of the standard metaphors for our relationship to God through the Messianic covenant. And you read these sermons in the book of Acts, you know, preaching the kingdom of God, preaching the kingdom of God. But you get to the epistles, and you find it implied throughout, but specifically mentioned very few times. Now, in Colossians, for instance, Paul says, "He has translated us from the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of his dear Son." It's there, but it's other words seem to be chosen. Why is that? Well, it may be that all this talk about a king and a kingdom is being misunderstood, and the church is accused of being revolutionary. So, and there may have been, a revolutionary element attracted to the church. There may have been some Christians who, in a misguided way, talked about overthrowing the state. So you can see why there would be just enough evidence, or just enough superficial evidence, or just enough alleged or seeming evidence for the enemies of the church to say, "Aha, you see, the church is a revolutionary body." Secondly, I think this helps us understand why the book of Revelation was written in symbolic language. Why is it the only book in the New Testament that was written in a cipher? It's not a very difficult cipher, but still. Well, the Roman authorities were pretty much able to figure it out anyway, but you see, the main point is that if I understand the book of Revelation, what the book of Revelation is about is the bitter struggle between the paganism of the early centuries and the gospel. You see, Jesus said that the gospel was going to win, and paganism said, Roman paganism, Roman state religion said, "We're going to win. We're going to stamp the church," made the church illegal, said, "We're going to stamp it out." And for a while it looked like they were going to. And so the promise in the book of Revelation is that the church is going to win, and that Christ is going to judge Rome. The Son of God is going to do to Rome what God has done to Babylon and to Egypt and to Jerusalem itself. Well, but again, this is not the same thing as saying that the Christians are going to raise an army and march on Rome. But you can see that I'm convinced that if the basic message of the book of Revelation had been written in straight narrative prose, it would have caused the death of many more Christians than it did cause. Because it would have been, everybody said, "Aha, you see, the Christians say we're going to overthrow the state, that there's going to be this great battle between the church and the state, and the state's going to lose." That's what the book of Revelation says, you see. Victory for the gospel. And by the way, it worked out, didn't it? I just simply point out, the church is here, been here for a long time, and Rome has been gone for a long time. And keep in mind that Rome said they were going to get rid of the church. Who got rid of who? Did the preaching of the gospel destroy the Roman Empire? Yes, it did, to a great extent. You know, the Gibbon's decline and fall of the Roman Empire? Of course, he was influenced by the French Renaissance thinkers, but he blamed the church for the fall of the Roman Empire. And he was pretty much right. Not that they wanted to, but you see, it wasn't that the church said, "We're going to destroy Rome." But you see, by the very nature of Roman state paganism, and the very nature of the gospel, remember, one would naturally undermine the other. Remember I said that totalitarianism must, by the very nature of things, control religious thought? So it was just sort of built in, wasn't it, choice? That because of the nature of the gospel, because of the nature of Roman state paganism, it either had to destroy the church or itself be destroyed. By the very nature of things, by the nature of the issues. Do y'all see that? Which is not the same thing as saying that the church had meetings and said, "We're going to do this, and we're going to follow this plan and overthrow the Roman state." In fact, they're not interested in that at all. Question?
You said if book of Revelation has been written in straight in prose, more Christians would have died, but would that have eliminated some of the problems we have today with the book of Revelation?
Yeah, it might make it easier to interpret today, I think. Although it's not all that hard. It's difficult. If you read it as a first century document, the primary mistake that people make with the book of Revelation is, and I'll just say this in passing, by the evangelical world in general, is that people, it's the most difficult kind of literature to understand. Apocalyptic literature requires more knowledge to deal with legitimately than any other kind of literature. You understand more language, more history, literary context, culture, and yet that's the very book that people want to get into the quickest. They have a morbid fascination with apocalyptic literature. In fact, the early century, early Christian centuries had the same morbid preoccupation. In fact, they wrote their own. They expanded on it and wrote all kinds of apocryphal books. We already talked about Jewish apocalyptic books, not apocryphal, but apocalyptic. And of course, they make the basic, most people today. If you turn on the radio, for instance, or the average book you buy at the Bible bookstore in the book of Revelation, these are written by dispensationalists or premillennialists. The average fellow on the radio or television is talking about the book of Revelation. Almost without exception, they make the fundamental hermeneutical error of saying, in effect, if I had written this, this is what I would have meant by these words, therefore that's what it means. And which is a fatal hermeneutical error. I won't get off on that. But you see my point? This charge of treason we're talking about. And perhaps this also helps us to explain the emphasis in the New Testament on obeying the powers that be. Which book, written to which church, says this? The Christians are to be subject to the powers, the political powers. They are ministers of God. To the Romans. Romans chapter 13, of course. And he writes it to Timothy. Tell the church to pray for those in high places. Written to Ephesus, probably. And again, that's Asia Minor, and Christianity was stronger in Asia Minor, where Ephesus and the seven churches in the book of Revelation, then the Lycus Valley. That was Christianity was stronger there than it was in Italy or in Rome. So you're right, and so I think this may be why they emphasize this. So they could technically say, so the charge is you're treasonous. Well, how can you say that? Look at this. Look what Paul wrote to the church. Be in subjection to the higher power. They are ministers of God for good, and they're not against us. And so I think they want to make that point because the church was being accused. But you understand where I'm going with this. But the church was not, as a body, interested in overthrowing the Roman government. But that the nature of the gospel was such that Rome must either destroy it or break itself trying, which it did. And therefore Gibbon, as I say, blamed Christianity. He was a pagan. Gibbon was. He was an unbeliever. And so he was kind of... He liked Rome, the Roman Empire, very liked the church, so he thought it was a bad trade-off. But, the refusal to swear to the image of Caesar clinched it. The government was already having trouble with all this kingdom talk, and then when the test of, and we're going to talk about the test of patriotic loyalty was made, Christians flunked it. Rome feared all rival organizations. And this is it's a part of its character as a totalitarian state. And the state needed the open total allegiance of the people, as totalitarian states need today. And one of the problems was that Christianity was so well organized. I just had a big laugh. Remember the 60s? This big move, the anti-organized church? Some of you don't remember that too well. There's a big movement against the institutional church. Some of it's left over. It was real big in the 60s with Jesus people. The theme was yes, Jesus, no church. up with Jesus and down with the organized church. And you often hear people when they want to have these little house meetings and just sort of really make the church an informal thing. Let's give you the church building. Let's all sit on the floor and let's the idea that the early church what I'm saying is, not saying it very well, is that still around the idea of the organized church as a pejorative term, or the organized church, as if, let's go back to the original church, away from this highly organized church. That's very stupid, very silly, one of the reasons Rome feared the church. It was so highly organized. Look at the book of Acts. Highly organized benevolent program under the elders. They even got more organized. They appointed men and they set up very... The church got down to business. They had work to do. And by the way, the primary work of the church was not evangelism. You hear this preached all the time. The Bible doesn't say that. The work of the church is saving souls. Was not. It was a very important part of the work of the church. The other, by the way, if you want to just look at what the church did and what it spent most of its time doing, the early church, if you just look at a schedule, a church calendar, it spent most of its time holding college, holding class, teaching. And spent a great deal of its time and energy doing benevolent work, we would call it. In fact, that's what you read about in the book of Acts. Certainly evangelism was sort of spontaneous. You find that was not organized at all. Other than Paul, of course, Paul's missionary journeys were organized, but they went everywhere spreading the gospel. But the church was involved in many things besides evangelism. Don't misunderstand. I'm not saying evangelism is not important. But have you often heard this? Evangelism is the work of the church. That's simply not true. It is a work of the church. But the training is the work of the church, and all these things are tied together. And benevolence was the work of the church. Caring for the Christians. The church has many jobs to do, and it's just not right just to elevate one above the other. And by the way, the idea, you hear this, everybody ought to be out knocking on doors. That's very silly. Preacher says that. Don't ever say that, fellas. In the first place, you're living in a dream world. There's, the church never been born since the church began. Everybody knocked on doors. In the second place, you don't want everybody out knocking on doors. You've got about a third of your congregation. If they went out, since they knocked on the door and talked to somebody, it's the last year to see them. I got a bunch, you know, we always had some people, the last thing I wanted was them out knocking on doors for all kinds of reasons. Maybe their personality was abrasive, or maybe they're just ignorant. You get a Christian who's 2 or 3 months old, they don't need to be out knocking on doors. Unless they're with somebody who knows what they're talking about. The idea of sending somebody out knocking on doors, who don't really know what they're doing, is not very smart. It feels good, you know, you sort of get a lot of activity going. But it's more serious than that. So I'm saying a person ought to knock on doors, but you ought to also spend some time learning what he's talking about before he tries to teach. Yes?
Would you say that any work of the church is more important than any other?
I don't know that any work, I would not elevate one above the other. I can't find that in the scriptures or in church history. One is more important. I think the lady, you get the lady who keeps the nursery on Sunday so that somebody else can go listen to the preacher, I think her work is just as important as the sermon. You have the concept of the balanced body in the scriptures. Everybody contributing their part. I didn't mean to get off on that, but I want you to get a picture of this that the church did many things, but it was well organized. And my point here is that Rome feared it because it was so well organized. Here were these very powerful group of people in their empire who really had their act together, and that bothered Rome. It bothers any totalitarian government. And you can see why, can't you? And last of all, one of the reasons Rome feared it as a rival organization was that no other religion was growing so fast. I mean, they have turned the world upside down, have come here as well, was said when Paul came to Thessalonica. And the Romans could have said that, and did probably. Think that this thing stopped. It's okay to have a new religion. They didn't care about that. But this one's taken over. And we do care about that. And look how well organized they are. And they don't worship the state gods. And we got trouble here in River City. The capital C. Church. Well, so we come to the... And then, in other words, an overall statement is that Christianity refused to be a department of the Roman government. Christianity simply refused to be a department of the Roman government. And so persecution began. And I list this under different periods. First of all, there was occasional persecution, AD 64 with Nero to 250. It's a long time. By occasional, I mean that the laws were sort of on the books, but they were not universally pursued. Now, the persecution with Nero began kind of through the back door, and Tacitus in his Annals tells about this, and Tacitus, you got to understand, didn't like Nero, so he put him in the worst possible light, but it's generally true. But all human efforts, all the lavish gifts of the emperor, and the propitiations of the gods did not banish the sinister belief that the conflagration, what's the conflagration he's talking about? No. Conflagration, what's a conflagration? The burning of Rome. He's talking about when Rome burned, wasn't all of Rome, the slum section of Rome, which is a large part. In other words, what happened was that Rome burned and the rumor was that Nero burnt it. Now, he probably didn't set fire to it, but he probably didn't try to stop it. The ancient cities burned down regularly. You get wooden houses with indoor, like barbecue, they were called braziers, barbecue, open fires in wooden houses jammed in close together. It's like the burning of Moscow. You know, Tolstoy points out that who burned Moscow? And he said, it just burned. Why? Get wooden houses close together, soldiers getting drunk, cooking on open fires. It doesn't matter who burned it. Did the Russians burn on the way out or the French burn on the way in? The answer is, Tolstoy says, don't blame anybody. There's no way it wasn't going to burn. The very nature of it. And so, well, the cities just burned. What probably happened was that it just caught fire, and Nero thought it'd be a good chance to get rid of some of that ugly section of town, so he just let it burn. Maybe he didn't have any choice. Well, they had a fire department. Augustus had established the fire department, and called the Vigiles, the vigilantes. You're going to word vigilantes, who watched for fires and tried to put them out. So he may have just said, let it burn. But anyway, people hate him anyway. He wasn't exactly the most lovable guy in the world. And so he went through all, what he's saying is that Nero went through all kinds of machinations trying to get himself off the hook, whether he was guilty or not. Consequently, to get rid of the report, that is, that he had set fire to the city, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, there's that word, you see, called Christians by the populace. Now, Tacitus, of course, is a late first century non-Christian Roman historian. Christus, which is a misnaming, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate, and a deadly superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, also in the city, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world met and became popular. Accordingly, an arrest was made of all who confessed, that is, under torture. Then, upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted, not so much of the crime of arson as of hatred of the human race. Have you followed me? Seen two of them, abomination, hatred of the human race. Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. Covered with skins of beasts, they were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames. These served to illuminate the night when daylight failed. Nero had thrown open his garden for the spectacle and was exhibiting a show in the circus. That was one of the amphitheaters. While he mingled with the people in the dress of a charioteer and drove about in a chariot. Hence, even for criminals who deserve extreme and exemplary punishment, there arose a feeling of compassion, for it was not, as it seemed, for the public good, but to glut one man's cruelty that they were being destroyed. Interesting. So Tacitus had... You care anything about who considered Christianity a deadly superstition? Didn't have any time for Christianity. Said everybody knew that if these people were guilty, they weren't guilty of anything like this. That Nero was just being cruel and treating them this way. Very horrible thing, isn't it? But again, you see, here this is not exactly official persecution because of their failure to subscribe to or give oaths to state religion. This is a case of Nero needing a scapegoat, and using the church for that because there was a lot of popular feeling against them. Okay? According to other sources, in this persecution, both Peter and Paul lost their lives. Now, that's tradition. It's probably true. You can't prove it. You got that? That in the Neronian persecution, AD 64, that both Peter and Paul lost their lives. Tradition has that Peter was crucified upside down. Said he was not worthy to be crucified right side up, and that Paul was beheaded. Of course, Paul's a Roman citizen, and that fits. He was beheaded on the Appian Way, according to tradition. Buried at Ostia, the mouth, which is the little community, mouth. Ostia means mouth,
the mouth of the Tiber River down the coast.
Persecutions came in with it, but the threat was always there. Not always actively pursued, but always illegal. For instance, it wasn't that we don't want a picture during this up to 250. We don't want a picture of soldiers regularly going out on patrol and rounding up Christians. It was not, but what it was is that if, say, you had a neighbor you didn't like, all you had to do is accuse him of being a Christian, as in him. So what they would do, if somebody were accused of being a Christian, then they would be arrested, and then they would be asked, they would give them the test, ask them to take the oath to Caesar. If they wouldn't take it, then they put them to death. Which is not, see, that's not the same as them actively, you know, running house-to-house checks and sweeping neighborhoods, trying to just find them. So, now the persecution under Domitian, AD 81 to 96, which was the background of the book of Revelation, and this was especially severe in Asia Minor. That's where the book of Revelation was written, to where it was written. That's the destination, the churches in Asia Minor. Are you with me now? Am I going too fast? So you had the persecution under Nero, first of all. Then it was sort of picked up under Domitian, 81 through 96. This is the background of the book of Revelation. Under Trajan, 98 to 117, there were sporadic persecutions. And again, it was not a matter of them chasing them down. And this is, here we have the famous Pliny's famous letter to Trajan, AD 112, very fine source of information. And let's read this. I put this in your syllabus. I thought you'd like to have this. This is good preaching material. It gives us real insight. Now, Pliny went over to Bithynia. I don't get to my map, but Bithynia's over north of the Mediterranean Sea. And Pliny went there to be governor, and he had a problem. People were accused of being Christians. And so he wanted to make sure he was doing what was right. Trajan wasn't very easy to get along with, so he wanted to check things out with the boss. And so he writes, "It is my custom, Lord Emperor." Are you with me now? This is Pliny the Younger, by the way, not the Elder. Pliny the Younger, who is writing to his emperor concerning his policy on these Christians. "It is my custom, Lord Emperor, to refer to you all questions whereof I am in doubt." Good bureaucrat. You take the responsibility. "Who can better guide me when I am in a stand, or enlighten me if I am in ignorance? In investigations of Christians, I have never taken part." This is all new to me, you see. "Hence, I do not know what is the crime usually punished or investigated, or what allowances are made. So I've had no little uncertainty whether there is any distinction of age, whether the very weakest offenders are treated exactly like the stronger, whether pardon is given to those who repent, or whether a man who has once been a Christian gains nothing by having ceased to be such, whether punishment attaches to the mere name apart from secret crimes. See, is it enough that they admit to the name? Do you have to prove they've actually done something? Do you let them off if they're young? You know, if they say I was a Christian, but I'm not now, does that make a difference?" Good legalist, wasn't it? "Or to the secret crimes connected with the name. Meantime, this is the course I have taken with those who were accused before me as Christians." You see that? He didn't go look for them. They were charged. By the way, in those days, if you had a neighbor, you just get in a fight with your neighbor, often he'd get rid of you just by saying, "Well, just report you for being a Christian." If you were a Christian. If you weren't, you could get off the hook. "I asked them whether they were Christians, and if they confessed, said, 'Yes, I am.' I asked them a second and a third time with threats of punishment. If they kept to it, I owed them for execution." Give them a chance, you see. Well, you want to think this over. "For I held no question to whatever it was that they admitted. I took their word for it, you see. In any case, obstinacy and unbending perversity deserved to be punished." And we're going to see this later. They were stubborn. Yeah. In other words, if they said they weren't a Christian and they wanted to go home and be a Christian in secret, I wouldn't have cared. But to be so stubborn is to insist on, you know, saying out loud. "There were others of the like insanity, but as these were Roman citizens, I noted them down to be sent to Rome. Before long, as is often the case, the mere fact that the charge was taken notice of made it commoner, and several distinct cases arose. When people heard that I was hearing cases against Christians, they sent in some new names, you see.
An unsigned paper was presented about, with the names, which gave the names of many. As for those who said that they neither were nor had been Christians, I thought it right to let them go, since they recited a prayer to the gods at my dictation. Repeat after me, you see. Made supplication with incense and wine to your statue, which I ordered to be brought into court for the purpose, together with the images of the gods. Moreover, cursed Christ, things which, so it is said, those who are really Christians cannot be made to do. Now, that's very glorious, isn't it? I'd call them in, I'd ask them two or three times, you know what you're saying, you're a Christian. Said that they said yes, then if they were Roman citizens, he would send them to Rome. If they weren't, he'd put them to death. And he said, but if they said they weren't Christians, I made sure. How? They said, I've learned that a real Christian will never make public sacrifice to the image of Caesar. So I just brought your image in, images of the gods, had them make this sacrifice. But they had to curse to say, Caesar, what they had to do was say, in effect, Caesar is Lord and Christ is accursed. And if they would do this, if they would say Caesar is Lord and Christ is accursed,